Lecture 23, Etruscan Legacy in the Roman World.
Let's walk through ancient Rome and see if we can identify which elements of Roman culture were derived from the Romans' predecessors, the Etruscans. To make this exercise a bit more challenging, we'll set our walk in the time of the first Roman Emperor Augustus, who ruled from 27 BC to 14 AD. Augustus rebuilt much of Rome as a Greek-inspired capital, famously claiming to have found Rome built of brick and left it covered in marble. We'll enter the city, as people have done for millennia, along the Via Flaminia, which runs from Rome through southern Etruria at the center of the Etruscan world and across the length of Umbria to northern Italy. First things first, we have to acknowledge that road building itself is an Etruscan technology. Roads were an Etruscan specialty. And not only this particular road from the 3rd century BC, but the many bridges with their arched spans across the Tiber River and its tributaries were also Etruscans. Without that Etruscan tradition, we'd be walking down a dirt path to Rome. Well, before we even get to the city, the Mausoleum of Augustus on our right dominates the Campus Martius as the largest building or monument in this newly created zone of development on the great floodplain of Rome. In shape, the mausoleum is based on the great Etruscan tumulus tombs, as at the ancient Etruscan city of Cerveteri. So if not for the Etruscans, we'd have to envision Rome without one of Augustus's earliest and largest structures, along with the bronze statue of the emperor in a chariot on top of the mausoleum. Because the Romans inherited bronze sculpture and chariot technology from the Etruscans. Just a little further south, but much closer to the road, is the Areopagus, the Altar of Peace, commissioned by the Senate in 13 BC. The altar enclosure is covered with figural reliefs, including a procession of Augustus's extended family, apparently on their way to the altar's dedication. As we admire the large-scale images, one might notice that all the men wear togas. Without the Etruscans, who gave us the toga, one might imagine a fig leaf instead. The priests carry emblems of their office, such as the lituus, the augur's crooked wand, which would also not exist but for the Etruscans. The men's bodyguards carry the fasces, that bundle of axe and rod symbol of state authority. Not without the Etruscans' invention, they wouldn't. Furthermore, the male youths lose their bullae, the locket amulets around their neck. If not for the Etruscan custom of equipping their children with such adornments to protect them from harm. Finally, the very scene this relief depicts is assertively Etruscan. It shows women and children taking their places in public roles with adult men, something previously unseen in Greek and Roman art. Well, while we're deconstructing this visual signpost, we should recognize that the very concept of the historical narrative relief was yet another Etruscan first, and portraiture too. So what are we left with without the Etruscans? Stick figures? No, I think we can leave the Greek-proportioned male figures, but wipe out their portrait features and togas. That seems kind of rude, so let's just imagine that they're idealized figures in tunics instead, in a scene that was mythological or timelessly generic. We'd better pick up the pace. We haven't even made it to the city yet, and by imagining a Rome that had never known the Etruscans, we've already destroyed Augustus's programs of building and the arts in the Campus Martius. Well, since the Campus Martius was the floodplain of the Tiber and largely a vast open set of fields, it became the default place close to the city for military training. So let's take a look at a military unit conducting training exercises there. Now, I'm not going to argue that the Etruscans invented warfare. I think that'd be like trying to figure out who invented the meatball. It's everywhere. but specific arms, armor, tactics, and unit organization differ from culture to culture. Swedish meatballs versus Italian ones, to carry the analogy to its extreme. Let's examine one soldier first. The standard legionary soldier is armored with a helmet, breastplate, and greaves, or armored shin guards, and he carries a shield. The soldier is also armed with a sword and a pair of light javelins to throw prior to drawing a sword and engaging in hand-to-hand combat. The body armor is pretty universal, but the metallurgy, particularly the processes that created strong bronze and iron pieces, was purely Etruscan. So, if not for the Etruscans, our Roman soldier would be armored still, but with inferior grade metal. The soldier's scutum, that is the large rectangular shield, was also Etruscan, as were those javelins. So in a world without Etruscans, the Roman soldier stands in poor armor, armed only with his sword, which in early surviving examples was actually made by Etruscan metalsmiths, so we'll assume a poorer quality Roman version. I'm really not liking this guy's chances in battle. He has one thing going for him, though: unit organization. The Etruscans fought essentially as individuals, while the Romans, in contrast, organized very structured military units, allowing men to support each other in battle. Without Etruscan-inspired shields, the Romans would have had a harder time supporting one another, but it's still better than the alternative. Except that battle signals were sounded by trumpets, large bronze instruments that, you see this coming, the Romans adopted directly from the Etruscans. So the Roman army would be far less effective responding to shouted commands over the noise and chaos of battle than they would be directed by Etruscan-style trumpets. Finally, along the Tiber, outside the city yet, we pass the ship sheds, where Roman warships are in dry dock. These warships are largely intact, except that each is missing the large bronze rostrum, that is, the heavy battering ram that projected from the prow, and which allowed the Roman fleet to sink enemy vessels without crippling their own ships. These rostra, in the plural, were very much Etruscan inventions. Take them away, and gone is a standard tactic of naval combat. Well, I won't go so far as to suggest that city walls are an Etruscan invention, although the arched gateways certainly were, as are the aqueducts carrying fresh water into the city from springs up in the hills miles away. But once you take away the Etruscan-inspired roads and aqueducts, Rome looks remarkably cut off from the world around it. So let's continue down our dirt path through the walls into Rome itself. Along the Via Lata, literally Broadway, we pass a number of public and domestic structures. Roman elites kept their front doors open during the daylight hours, and the front rooms of their houses were accessible to anyone who wished to enter, according to the Roman author and architect Vitruvius. We don't need to step inside, but we should at least peek as we pass along. What we see is a large rectangular front room called an atrium. The entryway of each house opens at the center of one of the short walls of that rectangle, so the organization of space is clearly based on principles of axiality and bilateral symmetry. The opposite wall is pierced by three openings, leading to three smaller spaces, the two on the sides accessible only by doorways, while the one in the center is open across its width. This structure is the core Etruscan architectural unit, which we see in the earliest surviving Etruscan elite dwelling at Merlo, and replicated later in the tombs at Cerveteri, such as the Tomb of the Chairs and Shields. So, looked at another way, without the Etruscans, we cannot imagine the defining public space of the Roman house. It would be gone, along with so many other essential features we view as synonymous with Rome and Romans. Gone also are the Roman household's realistic portraits of ancestors and their displays of armor and weapons. Essentially, all of the markers of elite status and personal virtue are no longer evident, quite probably because they no longer exist in this alternate reality we're visualizing. Assuming we have really good eyesight, we might see that one of the flanking rooms along the back wall of the Roman house is a dining room of a standard form called a triclinium in Latin, which refers to the three dining couches that line the walls with space for 9 reclining diners. Well, reclining to dine is an elite posture across the ancient Mediterranean, but the composition of the dining party is very culturally based. For the Greeks, elite dining rooms on the ground floor of a house were very often exclusively male space. For the Etruscans, by contrast, married couples were the standard dining party, which is the cultural pattern followed by the Romans as well. At the base of Rome's Capitoline Hill, where the Via Lata begins, we're faced with two very different urban forms, each of which owes its shape to Etruscan influence. The temples, surrounded by the remains of Rome's original fortification walls along the crest of the Capitoline Hill, reflect another early Etruscan form of urban planning. The Etruscans built their cities along hilltops, as Rome itself was founded on a series of individually fortified hills. To the right, dominating the southern stretches of the Campus Martius, is the new quarter of the city, laid out by Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa. This is Augustus's right-hand man, go-to general, admiral, civil engineer, and an Etruscan. Augustus never would have ruled the Roman world without Agrippa. And this quarter of the city would never have existed without him. In a city that looked, according to the Roman author Livy, like it was the product of occupation, not settlement, the Agrippan construction in the southern Campus Martius stands out for its orthogonal planning and its orientation to the cardinal points, that is, north, south, east, and west. Even the great public works of Pompey the Great, built 30 years earlier, don't align to the cardinal points, given their Greek rather than Etruscan inspiration. Agrippa's massive building program bears remarkable similarity to the Etruscan city of Musarna from the 4th century BC, with its division into 12 residential insulae, or blocks, a central piazza, public monuments, and sewers. Although it's sort of cheating because they really aren't visible, I can't resist pointing out that Agrippa's first work on the infrastructure of Rome was to rebuild the storm sewers and to organize the city into 14 districts as he tried to impose order on centuries of chaos. Well, along the banks of the Tiber is the largest component of the Augustan work in Rome. This is the Naumachia, an enormous rectangular basin, about 1,800 by 1,200 feet, filled with water by a canal from the river and used for naval shows. This sort of excavation is, again, a legacy of the Etruscans. Well, let's climb the Capitoline Hill and visit some of the most sacred spaces in ancient Rome. Blank spaces might be all that's left once we've erased the Etruscans here. The hill hosts one of the largest and, without a doubt, the most important temple in ancient Rome, that of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, the best and greatest. This is the temple at which every victorious Roman general concluded his triumphal procession. Such grand parades began outside the walls of the city, with the entire army showing off its loot, its prisoners, and its victory floats. The cult statue of the god Jupiter, its face painted red and its body clothed in a toga picta, that is a purple garment stitched with images celebrating his military victory, was the model for each triumphant Roman general as well. And yet, all of these were Etruscan traditions, from the procession to the toga picta. The temple itself was a massive structure, that covers an area equal to about two-thirds of an American football field, about 38,000 square feet. Because it's completely Etruscan in design, materials, and decoration, you can now conclude that without the Etruscans, it no longer exists in the Roman world. Everything from its foundations to its high podium, deep front porch, tripartite cella, and wide roof were Etruscan elements. The statue of Jupiter inside would also be gone, as would be even the terracotta sculptures that decorated its roofline. These standing figures were created by the most famous Etruscan sculptor of the 6th century BC, Volca of Veii. Well, the Temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus is only one of a very large number of temples and sacred spaces that crowd the top of the Capitoline Hill. And all of the temples were Etruscan in form. So Rome's entire religious identity, or at least every significant physical manifestation of it, would be wiped away, if not for the Etruscans, leaving the top of the hill almost completely bare, with only a scattering of statues and other votive monuments. Of course, any of those statues that portray a Roman man in a toga or toga picta would also be gone, or at least much altered. And no one would know who any of the images represented anyway, because all of the inscriptions on the bases were written in the alphabetic script adopted from the Etruscans. In fact, every bit of writing in the city would be gone, leaving Rome a completely oral culture. There's every reason to believe that blood sacrifices would still be carried out in a Rome devoid of the Etruscans, but not carried out in the same way. One key element of Etruscan, and therefore Roman, sacrifice was the examination of the internal organs, specifically the liver of the sacrificed animal, to determine whether the gods accepted the sacrifice or not. Given the depths to which Etruscan religion permeated Rome, it's impossible to say what, if anything, would have replaced this ritual, were we to erase the Etruscans from Roman existence and memory. There's just no evidence of a totally native Roman, non-Etruscan form of religious observance. The only other major structure on the Capitoline Hill, besides the temples, was a plain, roofless, rectangular enclosure that is made up of only four walls, overlooking the Forum. This is the 6th century BC Augurocolum. It's the space for public augury, in which groups of priests would examine the sky for the critical flights of birds that they believed would carry messages from the gods. Public activity in religious, civic, and military spheres in Rome was directed by the interpretations of these messages. Without them, public action might have relied more heavily instead on the oracles of Apollo, who were otherwise consulted only in the most dire events or for a second opinion. Without the Etruscans, the Augurocolum is gone as well, as are the priests, which is nice for us because it gives us a clear spot from which to look down on the Forum and to see what's left down below. Well, in looking down into the Forum Romanum from the Capitoline Hill, actually a surprising quantity of public buildings and spaces survives after all. All of the basilicas, the columned civic halls that hosted law courts and business dealings, and the curia or senate house are still there. Their forms might not even have differed in any obvious or substantial way. The basilica and the curia are native Roman building forms, but the men who work inside of them would probably be standing around, because the official magistrate's chair, the clearest symbol of an elected official, is an unaltered inheritance from the Etruscans, unchanged for perhaps 1,000 years. Public venues, including temples, amphitheaters, and meeting houses, like the Senate, were built to accommodate rows of these chairs, which were carried in for magistrates to sit on in exclusive seating areas, projecting their elite civic status. Images of these chairs are found on tombs across the Roman world, or rather, would not be in a world without the Etruscans. Among the religious spaces in the Forum, all five of the temples would be gone, as would be the regia, the residence of Rome's first kings, stripping the area of all sacred identity and some of its civic presence. That loss of identity would extend even to one of Rome's oldest rituals, the horse race held every October, after which the winning horse was sacrificed to Mars in his aspect as a fertility deity. Actually, not just sacrificed, its head was nailed to the wall of the regia, another Etruscan ceremony. This ritual subsumes three Etruscan elements: horse racing, blood sacrifice, and gods with complex fertility identities. The Forum's commemorative identity takes a hit as well. The triumphal arches, including those of Augustus that frame the eastern entrance to the Forum, are gone, along with any other arched structures. Well, the fate of what we might call the informal or more casual uses of the Forum are harder to determine. I imagine schools would continue to meet in the basilicas or under the porticos. Of course, they wouldn't be teaching writing. Surprisingly, science education, which we usually attribute to the Greeks, would be eliminated as well. The Etruscans produced examples of the so-called Platonic solids that predate Plato and Pythagoras. Leaving the Forum, we can walk, still in dirt since the road is gone, up the Palatine Hill. The major buildings and spaces we pass now are the temples of Apollo, Victory, and Magna Mater, and the traditionally preserved House of Romulus. But all of these temples and the house are Etruscan in form, and so they would also be missing, as would be the remains of the old wall around the Palatine, along with the marker that commemorated the spot where Remus leapt over it and was killed by his brother, Romulus. Since the notion of the city wall as a sacred boundary is Etruscan, it's highly likely that had the Romans constructed their own wall here, it wouldn't be considered the terminus of a sacred space. And so if Remus had jumped over it, there would have been no religious compunction to kill him. By the way, from this location, we have a great view. To the south, across the narrow valley of the Circus Maximus, is the Aventine Hill. And in the valley itself is the premier space in Rome for spectacle entertainment. Roman myths credit the first king Romulus with the first games in the area that would later become the Circus Maximus. It is, for example, the site of the infamous Rape of the Sabine Women. It's also an area designated for religious festivals that included games of both chariot racing and athletic events. Yet each of these components of the Roman ludi or games were found in Etruscan examples much earlier than the Roman ones. And there's general agreement that their practice was transmitted from the Etruscans to the Romans. Now, it's very likely that their ultimate source was the Greek world. But like alphabetic writing, the Etruscans served as a conduit for such cultural material to enter Rome. To break up the continuing litany of loss to Roman culture that I've been describing in a world without the Etruscans, I'll interject some exciting news. Looking west down into the Forum Boarium, that is between the Palatine and the Tiber, the Temple of Hercules and its great altar outside the walls of the city are Greek in form and origin. So they're still there. They are the only religious structures that would be found in this very old and important civic space. However, if we're able to see them, we'd realize that even the human sacrifices from the Second Punic War with Carthage, a very Etruscan tradition, carried out under the floor of the Forum, would be gone. Looking to the northwest, in the area known today as the Forum Holitorium, or Vegetable Market, we might be able to see the Theater of Marcellus, begun by Julius Caesar and finished by Augustus. Now, the first stone theater in Rome was the Theater of Pompey, dedicated in 52 BC in the southern Campus Martius. Despite the name, it was actually a temple theater complex of a type known earlier in southern Etruscan examples, such as the 2nd century BC one at Castelsecco near Arezzo. The connection of the theater to religious ritual was firmly established by the Etruscans, and that connection remained in place for the Romans as well. The forms of entertainment in the building, from acting to dance and pantomime, were all Etruscan. And the Roman term for performers or actors, histriones, comes directly from Etruscan. Even the peculiar seating arrangement of the theater, which I teach as quintessentially Roman, isn't really. The lack of seats in the first three rows is a design feature to enable magistrates and other elites to sit in their curule chairs, a form of civic identity well established as an Etruscan invention, rather than on bench seats. So the Theater of Marcellus, a stone theater with the Roman seating arrangement, owes its form and existence to Etruscan tradition as well. As for those entertainers, almost anyone you ask would tell you that gladiators are a Roman invention. But they weren't. In reality, the origins of the gladiator are found in the blood sacrifice component of Etruscan funeral ritual. Under Augustus, the Romans broke that tradition, making the gladiator something closer to the secular form of spectacle entertainment as we usually think of them. Augustus also made the bouts less deadly and held them in non-funeral occasions and contexts, including in the first stone amphitheater in Rome. But despite these modifications, gladiator contests were still an Etruscan invention, and so must be removed from Rome's urban landscape if we're to imagine a world without the Etruscans. By now, this might seem pretty grim. We seem to have removed just about everything worth seeing, doing, or knowing in the city. Not quite. We're leaving Rome with three categories of cultural remains. One, those it holds in common with other ancient Mediterranean cultures, such as altars, post and lintel construction, walled cities, houses, and so forth. The second, those things that are undeniably Roman inventions without Etruscan antecedents, concrete construction, bath complexes, imperial government, basilicas, the Senate, and so forth. Although I hope is now clear, the category of Roman inventions is far more restricted than you might have previously imagined. Third, we're leaving Rome with the parts of its culture derived from the Greeks. This is mainly seen in the veneer of art and architecture that Augustus and his immediate predecessors layered over the more traditional forms of the city. These include imported marble building materials, some building forms, such as the round temple of Hercules, Greek sculpture, authentic pieces and Roman copies, and Greek myths that became the predominant subjects of domestic art, theater, and some public art programs. But what is now missing is the Etruscan material that not only colors Roman culture, but also truly operates as its foundation. When we consider those things that generally define a culture in opposition to its neighbors, we usually select the most conservative elements, such as religious ritual, domestic organization, family structure, burial practices, and government. In short, how they live, worship, rule themselves, what they call family, and leave their dead all serve to define a society. In the Roman example, virtually every facet of these came from the Etruscans. This is of far more than academic importance, though I would never dismiss academic importance. Because of the self-conscious emulation of Roman culture that has existed in one form or another since the Renaissance, asking how much of Rome is actually Etruscan is to ask how much of Western culture is really Etruscan.